welcome to another episode of the Religious Studies Project from a sunny Edinburgh. I am Christopher Cotter, and I'm here with
David Robertson.
Chris's co-host, I suppose.
Indeed.
Chris, there's something that's confusing me today.
It's the sky, right? All the white stuff that's normally there is gone.
It's not. And my clothes are dry.
Yeah, and I seem to be... There's this kind of moisture coming out of my skin.
Maybe you should see a doctor.
Maybe.
You sound delirious.
I feel delirious.
But you have just been away at a rather intense conference, so...
I have, but we'll talk about that later on.
We're in the Abbey in Edinburgh's south side. I am drinking a pint of Green King IPA. And you're drinking a Sunbeam?
Sunbeam, I believe it's called. I think it's an English ale.
Yeah, we're on the English again.
Light and hoppy, perfect for a summer's day. What else is perfect for a summer day? It'd be a really interesting interview with a scholar.
And from our pal in Tennessee, yeah. Chris Silver. Like, where can you think of that's more summery? Well, Hawaii, maybe?
He is, yeah. He is a gentleman that likes the sun.
He is. So here is Chris Silver talking with Ralph Hood about mysticism. Take it away, Chris.
Okay, today I'm here with psychologist of religion, Dr. Ralph Hood from the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. He is considered an international authority on the field of psychology of religion. Today we'll be specifically speaking to the study of mysticism. Welcome Dr. Ralph Hood.
Thank you.
Let me first start off. How does one study and measure mysticism? I mean, what does it mean to study or measure mysticism?
It's actually a complex question, but there is a relatively simple answer. I never argue that I study mysticism.
Okay.
What I argue is I study the report of mystical experience.
Interesting.
And the report of mystical experience gives us two options. There are clearly the people all over the world in all kinds of faith traditions and outside of faith traditions that report a particular kind of experience that I identify as mystical. And that experience is some sense of a unity with something greater than oneself, that one can merge into or with, or a loss of sense of self that is seen as merging into or with perhaps another consciousness greater than oneself. And what I do is give people options of reporting those kind of experiences two ways. The first way I did it was actually from reading William James. And William James's great work on the varieties of religious experience is really subtitled A Study in Human Nature. Mm-hmm. And if you were writing that book today, I've argued many times, it would be titled The Variety of Spiritual Experiences.
Interesting.
Because what James did was make a distinction that's still debated, but I think, nevertheless, James is right. And that is he made a distinction between religion or experience, if you will, and the interpretation of experience. So his varieties of religious experience was not interested in religion, that is, belief or interpretation. It was interested in the experience that gave rise to describing things in religious language. And so what I did was I culled experiences from James's text and simply gave them to people in a measure I called the religious experience episode measure and asked them to read that experience and have you ever had anything like that? And they could say from zero doesn't match anything I know. To 5 or 9 or whatever scale I use, well, you actually stole it from me. So what I could tap into people reporting these kind of experiences that interested me, and then I could begin to explore what determined them, what triggered it, what were the consequences of it. And then I also developed a specific mysticism scale derived from the phenomenological work of Staes, which... in a work called Mysticism and Philosophy, allowed me to ask questions in a Likert format. Have you ever had an experience where a new sense of reality was revealed to you, etc.?
So in Likert, you mean 1 to 5?
1 to 5 or 1 to 9. And then people can mark that scale, and again, I have people indicating the report of experience. And the reason I make that distinction between the experience and the report, there can be all kinds of reasons people report or fail to report experiences that they may have had or not had. Mm-hmm. So it leaves it open to all kinds of psychological investigations.
Interesting. I mean, for the average Joe on the street,
or Sally.
Or Sally. Either way. How is this pertinent to them? I mean, for just the common average listener.
Well, it's pertinent in two very important ways. The first place is it's well documented that mystical experience is much more common than social scientists thought, mm-hmm. and that many people refused to report that experience because they were afraid of the response that professionals would give to it. Remember that there was a period of time when, for psychiatrists, the notion of mystical experience itself was pathological.
Right.
So people think they're having these strange kind of experiences that other people aren't having, when in fact many people have these kind of experiences, and frame them in different ways. So the first thing it does, it shows the normalcy of mystical experience. And the second thing it does is demonstrate for many people, these experiences are some of the most important experiences and the most transforming experiences in their life. And that occurs whether they express it in religious language, you know, this kind of conversion experience, this moment when their life suddenly changed, or in other kind of language that perhaps is not religious, for instance, in one of the more controversial areas where the experience has been triggered by the use of psychedelic drugs.
Mm. So you're saying that you can create a synthetic mystical experience as well as a natural mystical experience? I understand
you correctly. No, in fact, I don't like that distinction. What I would argue is that mystical experiences is what it is, but it can be triggered by a variety of different means. So, for instance, part of the argument for the ontological reference validity of mystical experience is it can be triggered by prayer within a religious context, by meditation in a more less religious context, for instance, in Buddhism. It can be triggered by the use of psychedelic substances. In fact, so much so that one preferred term in that area is entheogens, the notion God manifesting. It can be experienced by isolation conditions. It can be experienced under nature conditions and different set and setting things. And so the when something is triggered by so many radically different things, it suggests that the experience is valid and not a function of the specific trigger. Okay, so what I want to do is make an argument against the notion that there's a synthetic or chemically facilitated versus natural experience. And I do that two ways. William James started the argument by arguing against kind of medical materialism, mm-hmm. saying just because somebody has an experience that you can identify that's triggered by a particular physiological state does not invalidate the legitimacy of that experience. And Stace, in Mysticism and Philosophy, proposed the notion of causal indifference and said that whether the experience occurred approximately by the ingestion of a drug or by the folding of a hand in prayer, it doesn't make any difference. The experience can be identical. And Lasky, in a work on ecstasy, helped out by saying instead of talking about the cause of an experience, we'll talk about what triggers it. And under that framework, recent research at Johns Hopkins University has been very helpful in demonstrating that experiences facilitated by psilocybin in the appropriate set and setting are identical in all respects to mystical experiences that occur either spontaneously or under conditions of meditation and prayer. So that what I want to focus on is the nature of the experience and not evaluate the experience on the basis of what people think triggered it. So, for instance, I've done research demonstrating that if I have people evaluate a mystical experience and then I give it to groups of people under different conditions, I give it to a group of people where I don't identify the trigger. I give it to a group of people where I say this occurred while somebody was in deep prayer. or I give the condition that this occurred when somebody was ingesting a psychedelic drug, that depending on the open-mindedness of the person, they evaluate the experience according to the trigger. Mm-hmm. So if the experience is seen as being facilitated by prayer, mm-hmm. it can be positively evaluated by even a closed-minded person. But if it's seen as facilitated by drugs, it's rejected, and yet it's the identical experience.
Interesting. And it all has to do with the fact of how drugs are perceived, in a sense, right? Because of the negative stigma.
Well, it has to do with the notion that you evaluate the experience by what you think triggered it. But William James said, instead of looking at the experience on the basis of its origin, let's look at the experience on the basis of its consequences. So James said we can evaluate things by their fruits. And again, what I mentioned earlier is one of the things that's becoming more and more clear is mystical experience often are powerfully transforming experiences in individuals' lives. So, for instance, a site, the John Hopkins study, people found the experience facilitated by psilocybin to be one of the five most significant experiences in their entire life.
Wow, interesting. It's really fascinating. Turning back to, you mentioned that you created an instrument. You talked about your M scale. It was informed by Stacy, I believe. And so, what are some examples of where your scale's been used? Like, and I know it's, you know, you did it in the 1970s, right?
I first began devising the scale in 1975, was the first publication. And it is the most widely used measure of mystical experience in the literature. And it's been used in all kinds of studies. Okay. It's been used, number one, to assess the various conditions under which you can trigger mystical experience. So, for instance, the John Hopkins study that I mentioned used the M scale mm-hmm. as one of its measures, and it turned out to be the most significant measure used in the study. Mm. And that is the greatest change in any of the scale measures was on the mysticism scale, so that people score on the mysticism scale before they took psilocybin was much lower than after they took psilocybin. So it does suggest that drug actually facilitated this report of mystical experience.
Interesting.
And it's also been used to look at its relationship to other kind of variables that interest psychologists of religion. So, for instance, people who have a deep intrinsic mode of religion or religiosity score higher on the mysticism scale than people who are just extrinsically motivated in that classic Gordon Allport distinction. So it suggests that part of what's important about religion is that for people who are deeply and devoutly religious, they both appreciate mystical experiences and find them of if you like, ontological worth. And also that it may be that they are religious partly because they have had mystical experiences and therefore find a religious framing of the world especially meaningful. And it also occurs that what's intriguing is that probably the two closest groups of people are people who are devoutly religious mm-hmm. and report mystical experiences and people who are non-believers and report mystical experiences. Mm-hmm. So that foretold the distinction that is made now very commonly between people who are religious and spiritual and people who are spiritual and not religious. And the people who are religious and spiritual are these intrinsic people that have mystical experiences and find their religion an appropriate means of expressing that experience. And the spiritual but not religious people, a large segment of them are people who have mystical type experiences but do not accept the religious framing of that experience and so seek other kind of, if you will, secular interpretations of that experience. And again, that makes me want to continue to make this distinction between experience and its interpretation and argue against a total social constructionist view that says that all experiences are socially constructed. Mm-hmm. I want to argue instead that people have experiences and then try to find ways to socially express them. And the expression of that experience is always influenced by culture and language, but never determines the nature of that experience.
So, well, pardon my ignorance. So are you saying that there's an objective study of this experience, but it's still, for lack of a better word, a subjective, like in other words, an individual has this experience, but there's certainly an objective phenomenon going on throughout humanity. Is that essentially what you're arguing?
What I would argue, I always want to keep open the ontological question.
Okay.
And I think that psychologists who try to bracket that out make a big mistake. So while I certainly think it's legitimate to look at how experiences are influenced by social construction, mm-hmm. I want to say that people don't only search for the sacred, they respond to it. And so the question of the social psychologist is, what is it in reality that they're responding to? And my argument is, it could be that mystical experience is the way it is, because that's actually partly the way the world, reality is. And people try to find a way to express that reality. And the only way they can express it is in historical and cultural terms. But no mystic confuses the way that he or she expresses the experience with the nature of the experience itself.
Interesting. So in a sense, it's not so much that people are seeking it as much as it's coming to them.
And I think that while some people, and there's a huge movement in the contemporary psychology of religion to talk about the search for the sacred, and I think that certainly is a legitimate project. I want to argue in the classic tradition of people like Schleiermacher and Otto that people also respond to the sacred. It may be that the sacred imposes itself upon you even when you are not seeking it. So one of the works I like is O'Brien, in The Varieties of Mystical Experience, uses one criteria of mystical experience, is that an experience that occurred that was unexpected. It wasn't sought, it wasn't even known that it could occur, but it simply did occur, and then it opens up people to a wider dimension of reality. It's what William James said, is you recognize something more.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, and for our listeners, I don't want them to think that mystical experience or mysticism, the study of the mysticism, is your only field. So I guess to widen the conversation a little bit, what are some other intersections that your research has sort of had implications for, like the M-scale? There are other intersections with other types of psychological measures, other types of psychological phenomena? I know it's a very wide question.
Sure. My interest, it covers the whole range of psychology of religion, so there's nothing in it that doesn't interest me. I do think, along with William James, that mysticism, is, in terms of the experiential dimension, is the root and center of all religion.
Interesting.
But certainly it's not, you know, conclusively or inclusively all of religion. So I'm extremely interested in how experience and the interpretation of experience is channeled into various kind of efforts to construct an interpretation. So for instance, equivalent to mystical experience, I spend equally as much time studying the serpent handlers of Appalachia, mm-hmm. and particularly interested in their efforts to implement what they see as the imperative of the Gospel of Mark, where it says they shall take up serpents. And despite the fact that much of anthropology and psychology has ridiculed these people, mm-hmm. I tried to explore and find the legitimate religious expression that serpent handling permits. And I would argue that it does elicit in these people a kind of mystical sense where they are empowered and feel moved by the Holy Spirit to do things that otherwise would seem highly unlikely. And that is, it gives them power over nature, including even the power to handle serpents. And it's interesting that Otto, in The Idea of the Holy, also refers to similar passages in the Gospel of Mark, saying that the limits that people think nature imposes upon them are removed when one has this mystical sense of their unity with nature, and that they can do things that people thought otherwise they could not do. And I link that to the handling of serpents, which I worked for 25 years with Paul Williamson, who you're going to interview, and we'll talk about that much more specifically.
Interesting. Besides serpent handling, of course, what are some other areas that you've done work in that sort of intersect with mysticism?
Well, I look at the notion of spiritual transformation.
Interesting.
Religious transformation. So I've been working with several projects. I worked with the sociologist Margaret Paloma and Blood and Fire Project, mm-hmm. which looked at a faith-based ministry trying to transform the lives of inner-city meth addicts. I worked with Paul Williamson on the Lazarus Project in Nashville, where we're looking again at a faith-based ministry that tries to transform the lives of drug addicts. And I believe that there is a unique linkage to mystical experience two ways. I think that certain religious traditions, and in the American cultural scene certainly, the Pentecostal traditions, are largely experiential-based. And they require and believe in some kind of sense of the possession of the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit. And I believe that that has a mystical dimension. Mm-hmm. And I believe that certain faith-based ministries are much more successful than other faith-based ministries, or even secular ministries, for dealing with certain kind of drug addictions. Because if you like a kind of almost negative psychological assessment, they allow for symptom substitution. So the drug addict talks about this great high they have. And Pentecostalism, if they get the possession of the Holy Spirit, gives them a similar kind of high. And they get off drugs and high on God, so to speak. And the serpent handlers, it's interesting that the most common expression they'll say is, have you ever been on drugs? And if you have, if you've ever been on cocaine, handling a serpent is like 100 times greater than that. Wow. So the language of addiction is the language of being possessed by something. And it can be negatively in the sense of drugs, or positively in the sense of sacred realities. And so we're back to this mystical interconnection, that the world is larger than you think it is, and that part of the spiritual quest and the religious interpretation of that quest is always relating yourself to that something greater that you are part of.
Okay. Moving now, I almost sort of shift a little bit out of mysticism for a second, talk about your current research and some of the things that you're doing in the field of psychology of religion. What are some of the your more recent endeavors?
Well, the recent endeavors continue with serpent handling. I continue writing on serpent handling. I continue writing on Pentecostalism and drug addiction. I continue writing on mysticism. So it's not that mine are new things.
Yes.
But what I have done is I've written many handbook articles recently that allow me to reflect on the psychology of religion and where it is and where it's going. So I'm keenly interested in methodological concerns. And what I've been focusing on most recently is this notion of methodological agnosticism. And what I mean by methodological agnosticism, I'm keenly interested in William James's warning to psychology that the natural science assumptions by which it committed itself initially are only provisional assumptions. And so I think that psychologists have wedded themselves to a methodology within the limits of a naturalism that, instead of allowing a full exploration of the reach of reality, actually close off part of reality to them.
Interesting.
So, for instance, I've made a distinction, I tried to bring back a distinction that Deedes made a long time ago, and said there are four options for psychology of religion. You can argue that the variables that operate in psychology of religion are the same that operate anywhere else, and therefore it's just psychology. You can argue that the variables that operate in the psychology of religion are the same that operate in other areas, but they're more salient, so it's just more significant. And both of those say that psychology of religion can simply be mainstream American psychology. But Deedes gave two other options, and those are the ones where I think the future of psychology of religion lies. And one is the variables of psychology of religion may operate and interact with other variables that are actually of a sacred ontological dimension. Or there may be unique variables in the psychology of religion, right, at their own ontological level. I think exploring those two options are what's really exciting. And I think the way that's being shown is Lisa Miller's new handbook from Oxford Press is outstanding, because she argues the ontological issue in many of those articles, as I did in my chapter on methodology, and argues for a postmodern psychology in which spiritual realities are taken seriously in terms of their own ontological realities.
Interesting. So where do you stand on, I know a sort of debated topic in the field of psychology is the worthwhileness of qualitative methodology. Some psychologists want to strip solely to a quantitative, empirical study, which I know you do a lot of that research.
Yeah, what I've tried to do is to argue for appropriate methodologies to the question asked.
I see.
And I think that what psychology of religion is doing that's dangerous is it wants desperately to be part of mainstream psychology. And the mainstream psychology it wants to be part of is a uniquely American psychology that's based upon experimental methods and measurement. And my argument is that's fine, except it's extremely limiting. Mm-hmm. So that much of the psychology of religion requires qualitative research. And qualitative and quantitative research, you know, what I like to say is numbers and nouns have to start linking together.
Right.
And I would think that the exclusive reliance upon a measurement-based experimental psychology of religion is self-limiting, and even worse than that, self-destructive.
Interesting. So you would advocate for the method based on the need.
Yeah, my argument, my methodological agnosticism, which says a psychologist cannot rule out any reality, requires a methodological pluralism. You must use a method that is appropriate to the reality that you want to investigate.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Is there any qualitative research? Go back to mysticism for a second. Is there any good qualitative research on mysticism beyond the quantitative?
Yeah, I think there are excellent qualitative studies in mysticism. They come out of religious studies rather than specifically psychology of religion. But, for instance, one simply could cite the continuing, ongoing, masterful series of studies of mysticism by McGinn called The Presence of God, which is a deeply rich qualitative and phenomenological and historical study of mysticism, Christian mysticism, in its context. And we have similar examples for other faith traditions. So I think that the phenomenological work and qualitative work on mysticism is quite good, but unfortunately it's in religious studies seldom quoted by psychologists. And what I've taken psychologists to task for and continue to is the limitation of the reading. And it goes back again to the fact that they only want to focus upon experimental, you know, methods and measurement methods. And there is what McGinn has called an unrealized conversation, is people refuse to talk across their disciplinary and methodological boundaries. And therefore, the unrealized conversation means that each subdiscipline is leaving out much that has already been said if they would simply be willing to converse with those who have said it.
Interesting. So in some ways, you're not just advocating for a methodological agnosticism, but also a disciplinary agnosticism.
Exactly. I think disciplines have outlived their usefulness. I'm often criticized for not being psychological enough.
Interesting.
And my argument is, I don't know what psychology is.
Well,
I don't know what sociology is. I don't know what anthropology is. I know you can take a focus, and this is more anthropological, this is more psychological. But all of the boundaries are blurred. And most of the interesting research is going to be interdisciplinary. I myself was trained as a social psychologist under Paul Secord and Backman. And they wrote the first social psych textbook, really successful textbook, mm-hmm. that said social psychology needs sociology and it needs psychology. And what happened quickly is there developed not a really new interdisciplinary paradigm of social psychology, but a sociological social psychology that no longer reads psychology, and a psychological social psychology that no longer reads sociology. So my argument is that what's important is the question asked, right, and the answers that you can give, not the disciplinary framing of the question.
Interesting. That's really fascinating. To go back to a more basic question, if say for our listeners, that someone who maybe a student, a graduate student, or even just a general listener, was interested in reading on mysticism or the study of mysticism? Are there any sources that you'd, right off the top of your head, would suggest would be a good starting point for someone who's interested?
There are so many sources. I always tell people the first place is to go back to the classics.
Okay.
So the first thing I would always say that if there's one undisputed classic in the history of psychology of religion, it's William James's Varieties of Religious Experience.
Okay.
And I would always tell people to do two things. Get a copy of that book, or better yet, now it's free online on the internet.
Right.
And what you need to do is get a copy of it, and then highlight and cut out all the footnotes and paste them in a separate section. Read the Varieties, which is rich and conceptually profound. And then read the footnotes, which is another entire text.
Really?
Which is rich and conceptually profound.
Wow.
And most people read the Varieties and ignore the footnotes, and you'll see there are two books there that argue back and forth relative to the appropriate methodological and ontological statements that can be made based upon the study of the wide varieties of what we would now call spiritual experience. And then from that, I would say, begin to follow trains of thought. And probably the two big sides you need to look at is one, the social constructionists, mm-hmm. starting with the people like Kautz and Proudfoot, and what really is the main focus of modern psychology, which is rooted in a neo-Kantian notion that all experiences are mediated and there are no such thing as an unmediated experience, mm-hmm. and therefore the psychologists and sociologists are supreme in looking at how culture, history, individual psychology constructs experience. And then look at the counter to that. Read Stace, read Hood, read Foreman, who argue that all experience is not constructed, that experience in the language of Hood is expressed by culture, language, and history, but not determined by it. And then focus upon empirical research that always hovers around and is influenced by a serious commitment to the possibility that mystical experience reveals something ontologically basic about reality.
Interesting. So last thought, if someone was interested in interested in studying the field of psychology or religion, maybe they're a student, maybe they're just an average mm-hmm. everyday Sally, as you said earlier, what would be a good place to start? Like, if you're a student and you wanted to study in this field, are there programs that...
The psychology of religion is beginning to get a foothold in American psychology departments.
Okay.
But it depends on what career pattern you want.
Okay.
If you're going to want to teach in an American university, your best approach is to get thoroughly trained in mainstream American psychology and do psychology of religion as a subspecialty. So psychology of religion is often done in clinical psychology departments as a subspecialty, in social psychology departments as a subspecialty, or in some cases in personality departments as a subspecialty.
Okay.
But there are very few programs where you can specifically go and get a degree in the psychology of religion in an American university. Another career pattern is to work out of religious studies, mm-hmm. where religious studies have always been more open. And what you could do is be in religious studies and specialize in psychology of religion.
Mm-hmm.
But then what would happen is you would be unlikely to be hired in a psychology department, but you could be hired in a religious studies department. So there's really two different career paths. But if you get trained in mainstream American psychology, it's more than likely, if you're going to be successful, it's going to be experimental and measurement-based.
Interesting. Well, I certainly appreciate your time today, and thank you for letting us interview for the Religious Studies Project.
Okay.
So, thank you so much.
Cool.
Well, that was Chris Silver there talking to Ralph Hood about mysticism. A very interesting interview, I think. We had talked about holding that back and running it with another one later, but we thought, let's put it out now, it's too interesting to hold for next year. But, I've got something kind of important to announce. The our sponsors, the BASR, the British Association for the Study of Religions, are this year, I'm sure we've mentioned it before, their annual conference is also going to be the European Association for the Study of Religions conference.
And the special conference of the International Association for the History of Religions.
Indeed, so it's a big deal. There's going to be a lot of big names there. It's stretching over 4 days. It's in Liverpool. And we're going to be there with bells on, obviously. We'll make a few announcements about that further down the line once our plans have solidified. But importantly, for various reasons, the date for submission for panels and papers has been pushed back.
It's been extended. More opportunity.
Exactly. Yeah. To the 15th of June. Which is a full month from day of recording, and you know, gives you listeners another 4 weeks to get papers in, and I would urge you all to do so.
For you know, one reason, it's a great conference, great networking opportunity, but also you'll get to meet us, maybe, if you play your cards right.
Yep, and there'll be lots of big names there, not only the sort of legends of the BASR that we talk about all the time, but some big international names. So we're planning on doing a lot of interviews with European and American scholars that we can't normally get access to. So put your papers in, and panels especially. Graham told me they need panels.
Perfect. Well, there you go. Next week, we've got me talking with Peter Collins, who's an anthropologist at Durham University, about religion in the built environment. He's a brilliant chap, Peter Collins, and has a moustache to... I don't know if it would envy David.
It might rival.
Rival, yeah. He's a man with a moustache, and they make an impact. But it's a great conversation that we have. Conveniently situated in the very architecturally splendid city of Durham, so it's a good chat that we have there.
So join us next week for that. In the meantime, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, leave comments, criticisms, rants on the website,
which is fully functional at the moment.
Yes. For the first time in a long time.
And we've had a bit of an issue with email alerts and things going out to people, so it's all fully integrated back with our social media and with the email alerts and everything at the moment.
Indeed, but apart from that, the only thing left to say is
thanks for listening.